Okay, welcome back, everybody. Not everybody has come back yet. I'm not quite sure what that means. We'll see. Hopefully they're still enjoying their coffee and a good chat, and we'll come back to join us later. But for those of you that are here, you can get started on the next exercise, which is exercise 5. And here, fitting a data to the surgical, fitting a model to the surgical data. The file for that is also included in the practicals document, as is the data file and so on. Instructions for fitting the model are given here. And this time we're going to, instead of unlisting the output here and just treating it as a vector, we're going to spend a little bit of time examining what it looks like, what exactly is returned by the CODA samples function. So there's various ways to inspect it there. And I would just like you to get to the end of exercise 5.1. Then I'll recap and I'll compare and contrast fitting a model with RJAGS and fitting a model with the other packages. So I'll give you 5-10 minutes to do that, and then I'll carry on. For those people who are just joining us, I have to say there's been a little bit of confusion about what the structure of these tutorials is. I was given no specific instructions, so I decided to give a tutorial for the whole morning rather than two separate 90-minute tutorials. So if you're just joining us, you're coming in the middle, okay, just to make that clear to everybody. I'm sorry about that, but that's just the way that I decided to organize the tutorial. I don't know. I have to find out later what everybody else did. But this is that kind of a complicated topic. So in order to cover the material, I really thought I needed a whole morning. So sorry if you missed out on the start of it. Well, oh yeah, I'm not talking this afternoon, but I'm taking up the whole morning with one tutorial. I don't know, let me have a look. I'm really sorry about this, but I didn't even think about it until people started asking me this morning how long the tutorial was. The duration of each tutorial is expected to be 3 hours, so I'm using my full 3 hours. So if other people are doing it differently, that's fine. I'm using my whole slot. Okay, one more minute and then I'll start up again. Then. So, before I start up again, I've got a few announcements. First of all, it's been pointed out to me that this handouts document that I uploaded earlier doesn't correspond to the slides that I'm actually giving you. So, I've just uploaded the slides document here. So, you might want to download that again from the same URL. It's there, tiny URL. So that's one thing. Secondly, shameless self-promotion time. I am looking for a postdoc. And what better way to advertise a postdoc position than by telling everybody at the USAR conference. So this is my Twitter feed. My Twitter handle is Martin_Plummer. And there's the Twitter announcement here that will click through to the JAGS news blog. Hopefully. Wow, this is really slow. I should have done this already. Well, anyway, you only have to find this Twitter page, and then you can link through to the blog where there's a more extended description of the postdoctoral opportunity. IARC is the International Agency for Research on Cancer, and it's located in Lyon in France. And it's a very interesting multidisciplinary institute for cancer research. Still hasn't loaded. It's a very informal description of the project and the statistical challenges behind it. So, you might not be interested, but perhaps you know someone that is. So tell your friends, retweet or like the announcement. You don't have to follow me to do that, but it's a way of spreading the word. So please do that. I'd be very grateful because I'm looking for someone with strong computing skills. That would include everyone at this conference, okay? So don't think that excludes you. I have to be honest, though, we're not going to be using MCMC for this one, but we will be using a lot of R. Okay. Third announcement, there is a manual for JAGS, and I did distribute information about this beforehand, but since many of you have spontaneously arrived, I'll show you where to find it. So the homepage for JAGS, the SourceForge, the code repository is on SourceForge, so this goes back to the days before GitHub. And I'd never migrated from SourceForge to GitHub. I'm still on SourceForge, and I'm quite happy there. So if you go to there, the project is called MCMC-JAGS. And on the files, in the files area, yeah, I think I'm going to have to disconnect and then reconnect to the Wi-Fi. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so I mean, everybody's overloading the Wi-Fi here. So basically, there is a files area on SourceForge. You click through that, you can download the manual. Which I... which I have worked quite hard on getting up to date, because I knew I was introducing JAGS to a new audience here today, and I wanted to make sure the manual was up to date. In fact, the manual is more than up to date, because the manual that you'll find here is the manual for version 4.3.0, which is as yet unreleased. Now, it's ready to release, but I thought it was exceptionally dangerous to release something just before giving a tutorial, so I've not done it. All right, I'm going to do it in about a week's time, just to make sure that there were no teething problems with the tutorial. But it's ready to go, and I will be pushing it out in a week or two. And so the manual describes the new features in version 4.3.0, as well as a lot of the existing features, which were previously not very well documented. So let's carry on. And just to remind people, this is a three-hour tutorial, and we are halfway through it. So I'm sorry if you've just joined, but that's the way that this is structured. So we have this data on cardiac deaths in 12 hospitals. Let's read it in. And just display it there. So it's very, very simple data again, but the model is slightly more interesting. The model is called surgical.bug. Here we go. And there it is. It's a simple beta binomial model. So we're going to fit that model. And then I'm going to do something called burn-in. And I'm going to explain what burn-in is towards the end of this morning. It's an important part of running using Markov chain Monte Carlo. It's important to run the chain that's generating the samples for some iterations in order to get rid of the transient effects of the initial values. Because the initial values might be quite a long way away from the posterior distribution. So you need to run the model, do some simulations, so that you make sure that the initial effect of that is attenuated. Now, the $64,000 question is, how long do you have to run it? And that's what will bring us to the difficult topic of convergence diagnostics later on. So we run it, we get the samples. Okay, so now we've got this thing, this object. And this is an object of class MCMC list. It is actually a list. With two elements, and each element of the list contains the results from one of the two parallel chains that we ran. Now, there's methods for it. There's head and tail methods and so on. So if you use that, you get some interesting data at the beginning. This is saying this is a Markov chain Monte Carlo output. The starting iteration is 1001 because we did 1,000 iterations of burn-in. So we started sampling and collecting our samples from 1001, and the N one is 1007. Oh yeah, that's because I'm just looking at the head. I'm just looking at the first seven, and each column is the sample values for one of our parameters. So we've got 12 hospitals, so we've got 12 probability parameters, and so on and so forth. And at the bottom, we've got the attribute MCMC list, and we can do the same. You can get the end of it as well, just to show you that the end of it ends with iteration 2000. Now there's a summary function for MCMC list which gives you a rather verbose summary of the output. So let me just print that, and then I need to expand that. So there's quite a lot of output here. Okay. So again, we're getting the summary information about which iterations we've got, how many chains, and so on. Actually, I'm only running one chain this time. And there's two parts of it. The first part is the moments, basically. So we have the posterior mean and the posterior standard deviation. And then there's two estimates of the standard error of the mean. One is what's called the naive standard error, because it's just assuming that all the samples are independent, but they're not. The complexity of Markov chain Monte Carlo is you don't get independent samples from the posterior. You get dependent samples. And so the second estimate is one that corrects for that. Now, as it happens, this model is very well behaved. So these two things are very, very similar. But if you have a very badly behaved model, and I'll explain what that means later, if you have a model that's not mixing well, then this second estimate can be much larger than the first. That's the one you need to pay attention to, because that's the thing that determines how accurate your estimate of the mean is. Then down here we have quantiles. So there's standard quantiles, 2.5 up to 97.5. So these limits here define a posterior credible interval, 95% credible interval, because 95% of the samples are contained within this range. And that's basically your 95% interval. This also gives you the median, 50%, and some extra quantiles that you probably don't need, but you get them anyway. So that gives you the median, and you can compare the median with the mean to see how skewed your data are. So that's quite a lot. That's quite verbose, but I'll show you that other people have taken a different approach in just a minute. Just to show that if you want different quantiles, you can. There's a quantiles argument to the summary function, or summary method, I should say. And if you do that, this one just gives you the 5% and 95% limits so that you can construct a 90% credible interval. As with everything else with MCMC, once you've got your samples, you can do anything you like with them, and it's relatively easy to calculate any posterior interval that you need. There's also a plot method. So let's have a look and see what that does. Okay, yeah. So I often have this problem when I'm using RStudio. It doesn't really like my software. It's complaining that the figure margins are too large. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up an external graphics window and use that. Ooh, okay, that went past very quickly, so I'm going to turn on paging and do it again. Okay, here we go. So for every parameter that we've monitored, that we've set, we're looking for sample values on, we get two plots. So the plot on the left is called a trace plot, and it shows the evolution of the sampled parameter values with time, by iteration. So starting from iteration 1,000, ending with 2,000. And it's not completely clear here, but there's a small amount of dependency in between these samples. Not much. Things can certainly look a lot worse than this. But it's important to expect that in order to see if you've got good mixing or not. And on the right-hand side is the posterior density estimate. And it's not terribly clear from this with this resolution, but there's also a rug plot at the bottom showing you where the sample values are. And we've got one of them for each of the sample parameters. Now, finally, there's also a nice function in the coder package that gives you a highest posterior density interval. So you can just take the quantiles of the distribution to get an interval, or if you're interested in a particular scale, you can define the highest posterior density interval, like so. So that gives you alternate limits for a 90% credible interval based on the posterior density, not based on the quantiles. So that's quite nice. That was added by Doug Bates or DePayan. Can't remember which one added it. Anyway. Now, as I say, the RJAGS package is not the only interface to JAGS. Other people have developed alternative interfaces. And in the interests of being even-handed, I'm also going to show you very briefly what these other interfaces look like. So I'm going to show you three. And there's quite a few more. But these are the three principal ones. So there's the R2JAGS package. So I'm going to load that. And the R2JAGS package has a function called JAGS.
Michael?
Yeah?
This is about the density calculation. You mentioned that initially there are random effects, right?
Yes.
So do you have autocorrelation
that is the $64,000 question. So I certainly, I've got 1 hour left of the tutorial, so I'm probably going to skip ahead a little bit to get to the key question of convergence diagnostics, but it is included as part of this tutorial. So if you just be patient with me, I'll get to that. But I just to quickly answer your question, there is an autocorrelation plot here, which in this case shows that there's there's no autocorrelation in these samples actually, so you're fine. But there, I'll show later on in my slides. I'll show you an example where things do not go so well. So back to this, we've loaded the R2JAGS package, and that has a function called JAGS. And what this does is it does the whole thing. It compiles the model and draws the samples, and it even decides for you how many samples you want. All you have to say is which parameters are you interested in, and that's provided via this argument, parameters to save. So this is a sort of a one-stop version of fitting a model in JAGS. And let's have a look and see what it looks like when you print it out. So this gives you, in this case, you only needed one function call. And it calls JAGS and runs the does the burn-in and does more samples and collects samples on the parameters that you specified. And all of that is summarized up here. It says inference for bugs model at surgical.bug, fit using JAGS, two chains, each with 2,000 iterations, where the first 1,000 are discarded. And that means the total number of simulations is 2 times 1,000, 2,000. And then for each parameter here, in this case, we've got the mean, the standard deviation, some quantiles, and this quantity here, which I'll come back to, called R hat. And another thing called the N dot F, this is the effective number of samples, which is interesting because we've got 2,000 samples, but how much information is in those samples? Well, it might be that if you've got strong autocorrelation, then the amount of information is actually rather low. And you can see in this case, it's estimating that the equivalent information is only equal to 250. So if that was true, I mean, this is a quite a rough diagnostic, but if that was true, you would want to collect more samples and run your chain for a bit longer. It says it's a crude measure of effective sample size. And at the bottom, we've got some deviance-based diagnostics, but unfortunately, in this course, I don't really have time to talk about. Well, there's different ways of doing it, and no real agreement on it, but it's based on the extent of the auto. Sorry, who asked the question? You're down. It's based on the extent of autocorrelation. So the more autocorrelation there is, the lower the effective sample size. But my guess is in this case, these seem like fairly crude estimates here. So it's probably based on sort of batching and calculating the variance between batches. I mean, that's the simplest way to do it. So I've got this object called, what did I call it? R2JAGS.out. There's also a plot method for these things. And it's going to appear in our freestanding window here. So there's a lot of white space on this plot here, which I think is not particularly helpful, but at least it gives you a one-page summary of the output. So up here, we've got some error bars for the deviance statistic. We've got a visual summary of this convergence diagnostic R hat, which should be close to one. You can just about see there's a point there. So I mean, this is a very well-behaved model from the point of view of convergence diagnostics. And then on the right-hand side, we've got some points and error bars showing you the posterior distribution of all the parameters. And when you've got a vector parameter, you get multiple plots. So here P, which has 12 elements, we're getting 12 error bars here. So I mean, this is the plot that you might use to ask the initial question, like which is the best hospital, which is the worst? Well, the worst one, the one with the highest probability of mortality, appears to be this one here, number 8. And the best one is number 1, apparently. So RunJags is another interface. So let's load that. This, again, looks very similar. It's a one-stop shop for fitting your model. You have to give the model file and the data and the number of chains, and then you say which parameters you want. In this case, it's called monitor. Monitor equals P. Now, RunJags likes to run models a bit longer. As you can see, it says here, burning in the model for 4,000 iterations and then running the model for 10,000 iterations. So that's quite a lot longer. So the default for RunJags is longer than RTJags. So bear that in mind. That returns this object here, runjags.out. So let's have a look at that. Now, RunJags is giving you this warning here. No initial values provided. Jags will use the same initial values for all chains. So, I mean, this is due to a slight design error on my part. As I said earlier, if you don't supply initial values, they're supplied deterministically. But unfortunately, that means if you're running two or more parallel chains, you get the same initial values. And that's a bad idea. Normally, you should start your different chains with different initial values. So it's just dropping in a warning there. And then it's got a summary that's basically the same idea. It's giving you the some quantiles here for your 90% credible intervals, the median, the mean, the standard deviation, and so on. The mode is blank here because that's only used for discrete parameters. Some estimate of the Markov chain error, etc., etc. An estimate of the autocorrelation at lag 10. And this thing, PSRF, this is the same thing that we saw earlier, R dot hat. PSRF is the proportional scale reduction factor. And if your model's mixing well, and if you've got convergence, it should be close to 1, which, as you can see, is actually working here. And at the bottom, it's just reminding you how long it took. There's also a plot method. So, again, we're back to one page per parameter, so it's going to generate 13 pages of output, but I'll just show you the first one and then click through to the end. So what have we got here? We've got a trace plot, and this one is color-coded. You can see the two different chains here in purple and blue. I hope that's not a problem for people with color vision problems. Then there's the cumulative distribution function here, an estimate of the density. This is actually a histogram, if you look closely enough. And here's the autocorrelation plot. So if you use RunJags, you get the autocorrelation plot with it. So there's basically two aspects to this. There's the posterior distribution, which is here and here, and then there's the time series aspect, which is here and here. And it will give you both of them. And it gives you that for all of the parameters. And then right at the end, nearly there. Right at the end, it gives you this. This is a cross-correlation plot. So this is a visual representation of the correlation matrix of the parameters, where it's using this color code, sort of geographic color code here, sort of brown for high, blue for low. And the diagonal is obviously equal to 1. Because the parameters, each parameter is correlated with itself. But here you see a sea of green, because in fact, with this simple model, each of these parameters is in fact independent. So that's good. But if you're doing a complicated model and you can see sometimes that there's correlations between the two parameters, that's often a source of poor mixing in your model, and it's something to look at to see if you could might maybe address that. And the last one I want to show you is Jags UI. Now, as it happens that JAGS UE uses the same functions as R2 JAGS, so to avoid any namespace confusion, I'm actually going to detach that from my path first before loading JAGS UE. It's still overloading a couple of things. But. And it's the same idea, except with JAGS UE, you don't get default values for the number of iterations and so on. So you do have to supply that. But otherwise, it's the same idea. Whoa, spelling mistake. And by now, you should be used to the idea of what we're seeing here, because, again, it's the same idea. But in my opinion, JAGS UE is more didactic. It explains in more detail what you're seeing. So if you're just starting with MCMC and Bayesian inference, it might help you to use the JAGS UE package, because it will guide you through the output in more detail. Here, for example, there's this prefix here which is explaining the what you did and where these samples come from. There's this usual thing, number of effective sample size and the R-hat diagnostic. And then it's got some explanatory text at the bottom that helps you interpret what you're seeing here. But the JAGS UE doesn't have its own plotting methods. If you plot a JAGS UE output, you get exactly the same as what you get from R to JAGS. Just to show you that. Just the same things, trace plot and density plot. So there's. Okay, I'm going to shut that down. No. You've killed it. Here we go. Press the big red panic button now, don't I? There we go. All right, what have I done? Does anybody know how I can get out of this? Do you want to terminate? I'm just going to terminate the session and start it again. Now, I did want to talk about adding using a hierarchical pry here, but in the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead to the whole issue of convergence diagnostics, and I've got time. If I've got time, I'll come back to that. Okay, so some more slides. No, I'm going to talk about graphical models first, because I think conceptually that's also very important for you to understand what's going on here. So in a graphical model, random variables are represented as nodes and the relationships between them by edges. So in a simple regression model, it's not worth representing it in a graph, because the graph is trivial. So you've got your predictor variable x, which is fixed, and your outcome variable y, which is not observed. So we denote that by square for x and round for y. And there's the arrow between them. So the value of y depends on the value of x. So that's too trivial to even think about representing it as a graph. But graphical models become more interesting when we have multiple variables and the relationships between them become more complicated. So graphical models are useful because they're a way of thinking about representing complex multivariate probability distributions broken down in terms of conditional information relationships. Now, there are two kinds of graphical models, in fact. One using directed acyclic graphs and one using conditional independence graphs. And the one that is of interest to us today, sorry, I keep forgetting to expand this. The one that's of interest to us today is the first one, the DAG, the directed acyclic graph. Because when you write a model in the Bugs language, you are defining a directed acyclic graph. So in a DAG, the links represent directed associations, and they've got a little arrow on the end to show you the direction of it. And formally speaking, and don't worry if this is going too quickly, but formally speaking, a DAG like this describes a decomposition of the joint distribution of all the variables in the model in terms of parent-child relationships. This is in contrast to conditional independence graphs where the links are undirected, and it describes conditional independence relationships. So if you've got a path from X to Y, and it has, if you've got a path from X, any path from X to Z has to go through Y, that means that conditional on the value of Y, X and Z are independent of each other. So that's nice, but not the most important thing right now. So I'm going to skip to this bit. So if you define a stochastic relationship in the Bugs language, you're actually creating a graph. So if you've got a variable y that's got mean mu and precision tau, then in graphical terms is represented like this. So y, the variable y, has parent nodes mu and tau. And when you write this down in the Bugs language, what you're doing here is a text representation of this graphical relationship. And because we are Bayesian and parameters can have hyperparameters, when you put a prior distribution on the parameters of your model, you're creating an extra hierarchy in the graph. So here, for example, the precision parameter tau might be given a diffuse gamma prior, which is represented in the Bugs language in this way. And that's adding an extra layer in our graphical model where the parameter tau depends on these constants because these are fixed in the graph and therefore they're represented by these squares and so on. Similarly, we can describe deterministic relationships between variables in terms of graphs as well. So if I say that our mean value mu is based on this linear predictor, alpha plus beta times x, then that's represented in the Bugs language like this, using this left arrow notation, just as we do in R. And this describes a deterministic relation. So the value of mu is not random. It depends in a deterministic way on alpha, beta, and x. And in these relationships, deterministic relationships, are represented by double arrows. And the fact that a node is a deterministic function of its parents is also represented by a double edge. And in fact, this expression here is adding two levels of hierarchy to the model. Because first of all, we have this thing, beta x, the product of beta and x, and then we add that to alpha to get mu. So every time you add a relation to your model, you're defining a component of this graph. And if you continue in this way, for loops, I think. Yeah, I just got to explain what happens with for loops. So repeated structures in the graph become quite difficult to represent. I mean, on the right, you can see the graph looking pretty crowded now with the same relationship between y, mu, and tau repeated n times. So we don't normally represent repeated structures like this, but we use this plate notation here. So what you display in the graphical model is just one example of this, and visually you can see a stack of plates on top of each other, and the ones that you can't see represent exactly the same relationship over all the possible values of n. So that simplifies things considerably. And what that means is, if we're coming back to the linear regression example, the one that I showed you earlier in the Bugs language, can be represented visually in terms of a graph. So in fact, the original WinBugs software also had this nice facility where you could literally construct your model by drawing a graph. I never added that facility to JAGS, but it was a very useful teaching tool to introduce people to the idea of building a large complex graph from simpler components. And now we're on to the key topic of convergence. So you've seen some trace plots from our simple models, and these were pretty well behaved. But things are not always that simple. So what's shown on this slide here is trace plots for four different Markov chains. And all of them have the same target distribution. It's the standard normal distribution. But they have different, what's called different mixing patterns. So the one on the top left is the one that's working well. Mixing is good, and basically this is drawing independent samples from the target distribution. But as we move along from here to here to here, the mixing gets worse and worse. And you can see that in terms of the increasing autocorrelation, which means that if you take two samples separated by one iteration, these are very, very, very close, whereas here, these can be very far apart. Now, there's obviously less and less information as the amount of autocorrelation increases and the mixing gets worse. Now, it must be said that this is still valid. These are still samples from the target distribution. We're just not getting enough of them. So, there's one solution to poor mixing that isn't really a solution. It's called thinning. So instead of sampling every single iteration, you say to yourself, well, that's not giving me any extra information, so instead of taking every iteration, I'm going to thin the chain and take every 10th iteration. So let me illustrate that. So here's an example that's got relatively poor mixing. You say, well, I don't want to keep all of those. I'm just going to keep every 20 iterations. I don't know if you can see them, but they're marked as red circles. And I'm going to throw all of the other ones away. Now, although I've thrown away a lot of the samples, I haven't thrown away most of the information here because I've kept most of the useful information from this poorly mixing chain. And then you say, well, obviously, I don't have enough samples here. So I'm going to extend my run. And what I've currently got is just going to be considered to be the start. I've just compressed it on the left-hand side there. That's going to be the start of a much longer series of samples from the model. And that's what you get. Now, you can see this is not perfect, but it's certainly a lot better than what we started with. So by thinning the chain and running it for longer, you get a better set of samples from the posterior distribution. However, that's not really a solution to the problem, because thinning by a factor of 20 means you have to run your model 20 times longer. And when you reach models with a certain size of complexity, you realize that they can be quite slow. So if you had a model run that took an hour, which is slow, but still something you can work with, if you run it 20 times longer, it's going to take nearly a day. And this is not good. It's not good. Because if you have to wait a whole day to get your answers back, then you're just so grateful to get an answer back from the software that you really don't spend enough time actually critically assessing the model fit and thinking about exploring different ways of modeling the data that you've got. So this is not a good idea for good statistical practice. Oh, I've even got the formula. I've got a formula for effective sample size here since it's come up. So here's the autocorrelation function. It's the correlation between two samples from the chain separated by R steps. So row one would be the correlation between two successive samples. And if you know what the autocorrelation function is, then you can calculate the effective sample size using this formula here. Sample size divided by 1 plus 2 times the sum of all the autocorrelations. But that's only in theory. It's not particularly helpful in practice because you can't actually estimate this sum in an unbiased way. So there's various different ways that have been proposed to calculate the effective sample size. One is batch means. One is by truncating the autocorrelation function. There are spectral methods as well. And there's also approximation by autoregressive processes. So, I mean, two of these are in the CODA package. That one is an alternative that many people prefer. Let's just say that the effective sample size is only a rough guide. Okay? I don't think any of these methods are particularly good. The important thing is it's going to tell you if you're in a bad situation. You need to do something. So that's one problem, mixing. The other problem is convergence. So the theory tells us that the output from an MCMC run converges in distribution to the posterior. So as long as you've satisfied all the theoretical conditions for this to work, you get convergence. But the theory is completely silent on how quickly convergence occurs. And I'm an applied statistician, I'm not a theoretical statistician, but there was a lot of work on this topic in the 1990s, and there was hope that people would be able to develop a theory of convergence rates of Markov chains that would be useful. But as far as I know, that went nowhere. So we don't even have a theoretical basis for deciding how long you need to run your model for. So that means it's purely empirical, okay? So the usual practice is to discard the first part of the run called burn-in, and then treat the remaining output as samples from the posterior. So the two questions are, how long should the burn-in be, and how do we know that the Gibbs sample is converged after the burn-in? So these are key questions that you must address when you're using Markov chains. Well, this is a hypothesis testing situation. So ironically, although we're being Bayesian, we're back to a classic hypothesis testing situation. Hypothesis, null hypothesis, the model has converged. Alternative hypothesis, it has not converged. And so there are various statistical diagnostics you can apply to your output that are essentially hypothesis tests. However, it must be pointed out the consequences of a type 2 error are very severe. Your inference is invalid if you don't have conversion. So, you know, this is a high stakes situation and you need to make sure that you really have converged. So, back in the early 1990s, when people were first thinking about this problem, there were two schools of thought. One says, well, you want to do one chain and run it as long as possible. And the other school of thought said, actually, no, you want to run as many parallel chains as possible, starting from different values. And of course, well, I think the winner was this one here. Okay, but just to illustrate these two schools of thought, I'm going to show you two diagnostics that were developed 25 years ago. One by Goweka, and I'm sorry if I've not pronounced that properly. I never know how to pronounce American names, whether they're anglicized or whether they maintain their original, in this case, German pronunciation. So here's the Goweka diagnostic. You look at a single long run, and you test for the equality of the means between the early and the late sections of the chain. So it's essentially a t-test, basically, with some adjustment for autocorrelation. So how do you choose the width of the early and late windows? Well, there are defaults. You take the first 30%, the last 10%, for example. And this is a univariate test, so each parameter is tested separately. Of course, if you're monitoring a lot of parameters, you end up with multiple testing problems, but generally speaking, people ignore that. So here's an example where the Goweka diagnostic would really pick that up for you. So if you take the mean of the first part of the chain and the mean of the second part of the chain, that's going to obviously tell you that it's not converged. So it's useful in this kind of situation. On the right-hand side is an example of a chain that has converged. It seems to be sampling from a fairly stable distribution. And in this case, the Goweka diagnostic is going to pass. So the alternative, the Gelbin and Rubin diagnostic, which is the one that keeps coming up, the one that I showed you, it's either called R-hat or it's called PSRF. This is the one that people are really using now. So the idea is you have many long runs, as long as possible. And this is the key. You have to start with widely different starting points. So that's where JAGS gets into trouble, because it doesn't do that. It starts from the same starting point. So if you want to use the Gelman and Rubin diagnostic, you have to supply your own initial values. And then it discards the first half of the chain, just takes the second one, and then just basically compares them. If the chains have not converged, then they'll be overdispersed. And here's an extreme example of two chains that are nowhere near each other. And obviously, the Gelman and Rubin diagnostic will pick that up and tell you. But so will a trace plot. So Gelman and Rubin is essentially an analysis of variance. It's comparing the variance between chains with the variance within chains. And it's telling you if there's a significant overdispersion of the chains. That's basically what it comes down to. But this statistic we keep seeing, the R-hat, or proportional scalar reduction factor, is the within plus between variation divided by the within variation, then you take the square root. And you can calculate a confidence interval for this. And the key thing is the upper limit of the confidence interval should be fairly low. It should be about 1.1, 1.2, hopefully even lower. And if that's the case, you're in a good situation where there's no significant overdispersion between chains. I'm going to skip over that. So this brings us to the CODA package. So CODA, it's almost an acronym for Convergence Diagnostic and Output Analysis, but the letters have been sort of mixed up in order. CODA was a piece of software that was developed in parallel with Bugs. About the same time as Bugs was being developed by the same people. And at a certain point, it was originally written for S. At a certain point, I decided to port it to R and create an R package called CODA, which I still maintain. It was one of the first things I did in R, actually. So it's a pretty old package, but it's still doing its job. It's got convergence diagnostics and plots and various things to help you visualize and criticize MCMC output. And this is a bit out of date, but it's got fairly large number of reverse dependencies on it as well, because it just basically created the infrastructure for looking at MCMC output. Now, how are we doing for time? To decide what we're going to spend the last half an hour this morning on. There is actually an exercise on testing convergence. Might be a useful thing to do for you to go through that. So let's try that. This is exercise 7. And this is a specially constructed example. I'm just going to step through the beginning to introduce you to the problem. Here we go. So the data are in this file, stagnantdata.r. You can source it into R, and then you can plot. So there's two parts of it, there's y and x values. And what this is a change point problem. As you can see, there is a strong relationship between y and x, and it looks like a linear model that's got a kink in it, round about here. So it's more or less straight along this part, and more or less straight along this part, but then at a certain point, there's a change. So change point models crop up a lot in industrial settings, because the question is, when did something change? And the purpose of this model is to identify the point at which the slope changed from this to this. And it's going to be somewhere around here, but the nice thing about the Bayesian approach is that it will give us some uncertainty around that in terms of a probability distribution. So this is a specially constructed model because it exhibits very poor mixing, poor convergence as well. And the results you get are pretty much random. So when I step through this and demonstrate it, I might get something that's very different to what you get as well. So be prepared for that. So it might not work at all. You might find that it converges perfectly well, but we'll see. So let me just find the stagnant. Here it is. Let me just expand that. So this is a somewhat more complicated model. But you don't need to spend that much time inspecting the model. I'm sure you'll have time later. The key thing is that there are two beta parameters. Okay, alpha is the intercept, and beta is here. There's two beta parameters. Okay, the beta is the slope. Beta 1 is the slope at the beginning. Beta 2 is the slope at the end after the change point. And the question is, where does it change from one to the other? And that's determined in this model by a discrete distribution over all the observation points here. Now, it turns out that's quite a bad idea, and it gives you very poor convergence. So let me go back to the practicals document. So just in the last half hour, what I would like you to do was to fit that model. There's a bit of typing involved in this one because we are setting up the initial values. Here's one set of initial values here, where we're setting up explicit initial values for all these parameters, and that's an important part of this exercise. And then we're going to do it with, just fitting one chain and then using the Gorecki diagnostic to see what happens. That may or may not work. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then in the second part, with a completely different set of initial values, running two parallel chains, and then using the Gelman and Rubin diagnostic. So I'll give you 10 minutes to get to the end of this section, up to the beginning of 7.1, and then I'll do a demonstration of an alternative parameterization that works a bit better. See that? about another minute, and then I'll recap. Okay then, so I'm going to go through this surgical example. What you found might be very different from what I find here, but let's see what happens. So we're going to run this model for one chain using this very explicit set of initial values. And the most important part of this is this K in this model is the parameter that defines the change point. So what this is saying is that our initial guess is the change point starts with observation 16. So let's set that up and then run the model. Actually, no, we only want one chain. Some burning, that was quite quickly, and now we're going to monitor two parameters. One is alpha, which is the mean at the change point, and K is our estimate of the change point. And because we know, because I've done this before, I know this relatively poor mixing, so I'm going to run it for 10,000 iterations with a thinning interval of 10. So as I said earlier, once you start thinning, then you really start slowing things down. So this model now takes a few seconds to run. So let's have a look at the plot. Yeah, that didn't work. I'm going to have to open up a new window again. Okay. Ho-ho! So what happened here is that the chain suddenly jumped midway through. So it started off looking pretty good, looking like it had converged for the first 5,000 iterations. Then after about 5,000 iterations, it suddenly jumped to what appears to be an alternate mode of the posterior distribution. And luckily enough, that happened for me, and that means if I apply the Goweka diagnostic, it's definitely going to spot this. But you may have seen something different. For you, it might not have jumped at all. And in that case, if you apply the Goweka diagnostic, it would miss it. Because if it doesn't jump, there's no opportunity for the Goweka diagnostic to detect the fact that you don't have any convergence. In fact, just to see what happens, let me just run that again, see if I get a different answer this time. Okay. Yeah, it jumped again, but at this time it jumped a little bit later towards the end of my sample sequence. So you can imagine that if instead of running 10,000 iterations, I'd only run 5,000, I definitely wouldn't have spotted the fact that this chain hadn't converged. In fact, I'm going to do that. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to use the window function just to shorten this. Let's take it up to 6,000. So the window function is a function that you can use on time series, and there's it's generic, so there's Windows methods for MC objects. And with a shorter run, you can see it looks like it's converged. There's not much movement in K, our estimate of the change point. It's jumping between 19 and 20 here. So it's only getting two values there. You can see that it's more or less evenly divided between those two. But if you were to look at this trace plot, you would say, yeah, it's definitely converged. Look at the autocorrelation plot. You would say, oh, that's pretty good. There's not much autocorrelation here. And if you apply the Gorecki diagnostic, it would say, okay. The Gorecki diagnostic is really, really basic. It's just giving you the Z scores. It doesn't try and interpret that, turn it into P values, for example. But these aren't extreme values. You need something of the order of 1.96, obviously, or 2, to say that it looked like there was evidence of lack of convergence. But with a shorter run, you would definitely be in trouble. Just to convince you that the Gorecki diagnostic does work, let me go back and fit this again. Now, hopefully it has jumped this time. Let's have a look. Yeah, it jumped. Okay. So in this case, it jumps quite early. In fact, there seem to be two jumps here. It seems to have stay in this intermediate state for a while before jumping again. So in this case, the Gorecki diagnostic, it's still not great, is it? It's it's giving you some indication that things aren't great, but really the trace plot would reveal it in this case. So let's try that again, but this time running two parallel chains from different starting points. And again, the key thing here is that this time we're saying the change point is observation 8, and that means also we have to change the initial values for alpha, because that's the mean at the change point. So that's where these two initial values differ. So run that and update it for 1,000 iterations and draw again 10,000 iterations with a thinning interval of 10. And it's running even slower now because I'm running two parallel chains. So now when we plot, we should get two parallel trace plots for the two chains. And now you begin to understand the extent of the problem. In fact, neither of these chains is as converged. They are both strongly disagreeing with each other. The red chain, which is chain number 2, that seems to be perfectly happy where it is. The other chain, the black chain, chain number 1, it's jumping about a bit, but it's still nowhere near chain 2. So let's have a look at the Gelman and Rubin diagnostic. Okay. So this is the proportional scale reduction factor, which looks at the ratio between and within variance. It's up at 8.27. As you recall, it really needs to be down at 1. Oh, there's two versions of this, actually. This is the multivariate version, and there's one for each individual parameter. And in fact, the upper confidence interval for these is so high. I mean, we're clearly in trouble here. But as I say, this example was specifically designed to give us poor mixing. And I'll explain why it's giving us poor mixing. Because there's an alternative model. The alternative model, get back to my exercises. There's an alternative model that uses a continuous parameterization. So the problem with our change point model before is that it assumed that the change point happened at one of the observations. This alternative parameterization allows the change point to be anywhere, including in between two. Oh, no, that's not right. I'm not else, thank you. In between two observations. So that's the difference between the two. And it turns out that that one works somewhat better. So let's run that. Now that we've established we need two parallel chains, let's just run the whole thing. This one's also working a lot better. It's a lot faster. Actually, you often find that. You often find that when you've got numerical problems in your model, that it's also really, really slow. So there's an interesting relationship between the speed, numerical problems, poor conversions, poor mixing, and just poorly specified models. It's difficult to make very precise. But. So let's have a look at this now. Yeah, that works pretty well. So now we've got the red chain and the black chain, and they're both agreeing with each other. They both converged from widely different starting points because I did exactly the same thing as I did before. And let's have a look at the autocorrelation. Well, the autocorrelation is not that great, actually, if I'm honest. Even if you go up to a lag of around 50, it's still of the order of a sort of 0.3, 0.4. And there is a reason for that. But let's just check the Gelman and Rubin convergence diagnostic. Oh, sorry. Okay, that's looking a bit better. It's looking a bit better. The point estimate, 1.05, 1.04. But the upper confidence interval is still out of the range that we feel comfortable with. And what that tells you is you need to run the chain for a little bit longer, and then you should be able to get the proportion, potential scale reduction factor down to an acceptable level. Now, just to explain where this problem is coming from, I'm going to show you a cross-correlation between two parameters. Alpha is the mean at the change point, and x dot change in this continuous parameterization is the location of the change point. And as you can see, these have a strong negative correlation. So it's around minus 0.95. That's really, really strong. And that's the source of all our problems. It's the source of the poor convergence in the discrete model, and it's the source of the poor mixing in the continuous model. In fact, I can probably do a... I'm being a bit ambitious here doing this on the fly, but... can't spell default. I'm using plot.default here because I want to do cross plot between two parameters, whereas plot, being a generic method, will just dispatch on the first argument that I give it. So if you want to do this kind of thing, you need to work around the nope, doesn't like it. Subscript out of bounds. Oh no, it's S3 I want, isn't it? Okay, that worked. So that's looking at the cross, alpha, the mean at the change point on the x-axis, and x dot change, the location of the change point. And as you can see, these are highly correlated. And when you're in this situation, when you've got different parameters in the model that are highly correlated, well, good old-fashioned Gibbs sampling isn't really going to get the job done very efficiently. The good news is that there are sampling methods in JAGS that can update more than one parameter at a time and that overcome this problem. The GLM module is a module that extends JAGS to allow you to work efficiently with generalized linear models. That's one example. There are others. But as I see, we're kind of out of time now. So it feels like I've ended this tutorial on a rather sad note, but I don't want to discourage you from using JAGS and MCMC. I just need you to be aware of of the limitation. So that's why I put this cautionary tale in the tutorial. But if you are carefully armed with all the diagnostic tools and you use them, you should be able to navigate your way through these difficulties. So I suppose just to end, there's one more thing. Earlier on, I did manage to connect again. This is the SourceForge site, and as part of that, in the files area, if you go to manuals 4.x, you'll find in there the JAGS user manual, which is what I was talking about earlier, the newly updated manual that explains the facilities of JAGS in more detail. So just, are there any questions before we wrap up? Yes. Yeah, I knew someone was going to ask about that, yeah. What do you want me to say? It's an alternate software. What do you think I'm going to say? There's actually a lot of software out there for doing MCMC. I mentioned Nimble earlier. There's other projects out there as well. Stan is one of them. I'll be honest with you. There is a limitation to bugs in terms of memory, because when you use one of these models, you're using a lot of memory because you are internally building a virtual graphical model. And it turns out that's a clear design limitation that I can never overcome, that these models are going to use a lot of memory. So it's never going to work. JAGS is never going to work, at least in its current form, on big, big problems. So that's certainly something that Stan overcomes. Okay. On the other hand, the people that wrote Stan are computer scientists rather than statisticians. And they made some design decisions that go a different way. For example, in your model, you have to explicitly say what is data, what is parameter. Now, you might be comfortable with that, or you might not be. But certainly in a situation when you have missing data, you're suddenly in trouble, because then it gets very complicated to define what's parameter, what's data. The second limitation of Stan is that it doesn't handle discrete valued parameters. But there are ways of working around that. You can always marginalize them out, and that's the technique that they use. So Stan, faster, capable of running bigger problems, does have some limitations, and I think you probably have to be more of a programmer to use it. I'm not saying that you can't use it, but it probably got a bit of a steeper learning curve. Yeah. But, you know, everybody's in this situation. We're here at the USAR conference, but as everybody knows, Julia is the up-and-coming language for scientific computing and data science. So, you know, it's faster, it works in a parallel computing environment, and all the cool kids are using it. So, you know, this is not a situation that's specific to JAGS. It's everybody's in this situation. All right, well, I thank you very much for coming. I hope that you've enjoyed this brief introduction to JAGS. There is much more, of course. And if you want me to come back to your institution to give the long form of this course, then we can talk. But otherwise, enjoy the rest of the conference, and I look forward to further discussions with you if you want. You can approach me anytime. Thank you very much.